Blog Talk Radio.
Held us down, but now it looks like things are finally coming around. I know we've got a long, long way to go, and where we'll end up, I don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're putting our shirt together, we're polishing up our act.
Down in Alabama, in Georgia, South Carolina. 25 years while I write. We can hear voices telling us to slow up. We can hear voices telling us to cool off. Our only answer in conversation time must be that we have cooled off too long, and if we keep cooling off, we'll end up in a deep freeze.
It is Friday night. It's the Black Business Billionaires Network Club. I am your host, Reverend Ron, Dr. Robinson, Mr. Electric. They call me so many things, wear so many hats, but we're here tonight to discuss many, many things that are happening in the African-American community. We're talking about good things that are happening, the bad things that are happening. There's so much stuff going on. There's a political war. Economics is going off the whack. Jobs are going down. The economy is getting clambered. There is a new system, digital finance system now. They just put in place February 1st. The President of the United States signed the bill. I think it's 104-270, which is to turn all the banking system into a digital system. And so there are many things happening in the community itself. And we're going to take a little commercial break, and we shall be right back with you with more news, more information, more things that are happening. There is so much economic opportunities now. We got a business that is going off the hook. The opportunity is just so tremendous to make tons of money. People making $25,000 in 3 days. Sleeping. A magnificent mattress, magnificent bedspreads. Eye covering for the night that will take away cataracts and help you to heal your body from sciatica, from pain, from arthritis, gout. These incredible crystals inside of these particular type of sheets and pillowcases that heals your body while you're sleeping. And it's all over the world. People are making crazy money in 3 to 2 days, thousands, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, in 2 or 3 days. So if you're interested, stay tuned. We're going to talk about all of this and what's happening in the news when we come back. Thank you.
Entertainment. Worldwide. Network. We on live. We in your speakers. And on your mind. Ten the clock. We on time.
Yes, this is Lenny Williams. I'm out here in Oakland, California.
I'm Lisa Wade. I sign on a payment with the NWA, Dr. Dre, and Eazy-E.
It's Just Will, Black Pearl Entertainment artist, newly signed to I Am Jesus Records. You're listening to the Entertainment Worldwide Network with Don Jr., CEO. Coming to you live, this is business, so pay attention.
Yo, it's your boy LV the Slap Thing, and I'm over here chilling with my guy, The Plug, Don Jr., CEO, Entertainment Worldwide Network Radio. You dig?
What's good, homie?
This your boy, Big D.
It's your folk, Chuck and Traps.
This your peeps, Captain Mac.
I let your boy, Boss Lena.
It's your boy, Brick Boy Rico.
It's your boy, Joe Dirt.
Hey, yo, what up? It's your boy, Buddha, a.k.a. Buddy Miles.
Yo, what's good? It's the Vic Percy Jones.
And Big Cell is now in your area.
Yo, this your boy, Mr. Hamson.
It's your girl, Lady Duet.
It's just Rich Gates.
This your bro, JT, Mr. Guaranteed the Rick.
Yo, this your dude, Insane G.
What up? This your boy, Jihad, a.k.a. J Hood.
Yo, this your folks, Young Birds.
Yo, this your folk, GB Cooney.
Yo, this is Mike G Jungle. Hey, what it do? It's your boy, Saves Money.
This your boy, Big Chad Domingo.
Bye-bye. Salute the big dog.
This your boy, Jay Futuristic.
This your folk, Lil Raheem. You did.
I am Geronimo Beals. Off the deep end. Getting blessings. Wise Life Records. And you're listening to the Entertainment Worldwide Network with Don Jr., the CEO, coming to you live.
Hey, what it do? This is Charlie Boy, the Versatile Charlie.
You're listening to the hottest radio station.
Are you ready to be inspired, uplifted, enlightened, and entertained? Judge Joe Brown is an all-American judge, lawyer, and television personality. Judge Joe Brown was raised in the Crenshaw District of Los Angeles, California. Overcoming the harsh streets of L.A., he graduated at the top of his class from Dorsey High School. He then went on to earn his bachelor's degree in political science at UCLA. Judge Joe Brown is a member of the Phi Alpha fraternity and became the first African-American prosecutor in Memphis, Tennessee. He then opened his own practice before becoming a judge on the State Criminal Court of Shelby County, Tennessee. Judge Joe Brown was then thrusted into the national spotlight, proceeding over James Earl's last appeal for race conviction for the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He then caught the attention of producers of Judge Judy and is now the arbiter of his own arbitration-based reality court TV show that has been recorded for over 16 years. This show is syndicated on Bounce and available to millions of homes across America. Judge Joe Brown has been on a mission to educate the leaders of the future and has started a movement titled Sag Pants Equals a Sag Mind. This is a call to action. Let's talk and change the world. Judge Joe Brown is ready to speak at your next event. Follow Judge Joe Brown at Judge Joe Brown TV on Twitter. This message has been brought to you by 2Deep, owner of KFSM Radio and Bloody Rain Productions, and Pastor Don Jr., CEO of the winning team. Contact 2Deep at 337-936-5176 or Pastor Don Jr. at 818-358-5722.
The NEO Project is a business network collective of professional CEOs, community leaders, doctors, recording artists, label owners, lawyers, judges, business owners, entrepreneurs, recording artists, and major connections across the globe. For more information, visit www.myprojectneo.org or call 800-249-8830. We have a live conference call, Join in the Conversation, hosted by Dr. Rev Robinson Sr. and Dr. Winborn. Share your ideas about growing your business. New ideas, featured partner, video promo, social media, exposure, rotation, profit sharing, meetups at your establishment. Join the conference call on Blog Talk Radio Thursday and Friday, 7 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time. Sunday, 7 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time. Live Talk with Eva. Call 347-857-1311. Press 1 to speak on freeconferencecall.com. Saturday, 12 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time. Call into 515-604-9642. Access code 910488. If you have Metro PCS, hashtag T-Mobile or Boost Mobile, call 206-451-6043, then 515-604-9642, access code 910488. If you have Metro PCS, T-Mobile, or Boost Mobile, dial 206-451-6043, then 515-604-9642, access code 910488. Financial consulting and investments, call DSNR Consultants LLC Corporate Office, 914-363-9007. Text 518-866-7605. Email RevRunRobinson, RevRun11@gmail.com. Shout out to Pastor Don Jr., CEO, and Keisha Miss, CEO, and the 300 Elite members, also 3 Max and a Nerd, and Andrea's Talent Management.
Fashion is SoSeductiveLive.com. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com. SoSeductiveLive has the best apparel from Gucci, Prada, Fendi, Guess, Rolex, Nike, Tiara Michelle, True Religion, Louis Vuitton.
Greetings, I'm Miss K, CEO and founder of SoSeductive Shoes and Fashion. I started my company to keep you informed. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com. I believe in fashion, so SoSeductive is fun and needs to be seen. I want to inspire people just like you. I want someone to look at me and say, because because of you, I didn't give up. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com. I am Miss K, CEO and founder of Soul Seductive Shoes and Fashion. You can find me on your favorite social network at Keisha Miss CEO. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com.
There's a lot to learn in the music business, and without a teacher, it gets even harder and very costly. Introducing the Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint. Don Jr., CEO of the Entertainment Worldwide Network, has put together a detailed book to take your career to the next level in the entertainment business. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint will teach you the do's and don'ts of the entertainment industry, starting from the beginning to the end. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint covers the topics of business plan, logo design, CD design layout, sales, radio airplay, CD marketing strategy, massive emailing, CD sales one sheet, press kit, media kit, online media kit, internet marketing, MP3 online distribution, hip-hop blog sites, hip-hop magazine, hip-hop DVDs, mixtapes, street teams, music publishing and royalties, music lawyers, tour booking, and more. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint is available only by contacting Don Jr., CEO, at 818-358-5722 or email donjrceo@gmail.com.
Do you need more exposure? Do you need more fans? Are you planning to be wealthy and successful in business? The 365 Days of Radio campaign is a business training program teaching you how to build your brand, business, product, or service, how to meet and network with people in other cities, how to make connections with other business owners, and how to talk about your business on an open platform. All the tools you need before you speak to investors, advertisers, and or sponsors. Are you ready to receive money and make it to the next level? Education is the key to success, and experience is the best teacher. Learn from the comfort of your own personal remote location. The 365-day radio campaign is a business training program. For business training, tuition, schedules, and fees, please call Pastor Don Jr., CEO, and the winning team at 818-358-5722. That's right, Pastor Don Jr., CEO of the winning team at 818-358-5722.
And we're back, and we're back, we're back, we're back. We have to try to consider all of our needs. And there's this fabulous, fabulous, fabulous Sleep M sheets and pillowcases and a mattress. You can buy the mattress. You can buy the mattress form to go on top of your mattress. You can buy the pillowcases, the sheets, the covers. It is just fabulous. It has these crystals in it, and it heals your body. People have been redeemed, let's say, or found significant improvement with sciatica, with gout, with arthritis. Even people found weight loss, headaches. There's even a iPad that you put on your eyes, and it helps correct cataracts and et cetera. These are just fabulous products. There's just crystals in them that just give them an amazing healing, helping you to redeem yourself from physical disability, pains and suffering, back pain, leg pain, knee pain, joint pains. And it's just a miracle. These fabulous bedspreads and sheets, you put on your bed, so you're sleeping at night and your body is getting this healing process going on. It is just fantastic. And it's also a great opportunity as a business. Folks are sister friend of mine. She showed me a check. She makes every 3 days $25,000. It's amazing because this product is all over the world. They haven't penetrated 1% of the market yet, But when people get to see the videos and the tapes and et cetera, they're extremely excited about these products. And these products having a profound effect on them physically, physiologically, psychologically. It's having a tremendous effect on people. And so people are experiencing miracles. I'm ordering my mattresses and pillowcases and the eye covering. I have a cataract, so I'm going to order the eye covering to see how it works with that before I go for surgery. So I'm getting to use the products. I know everybody like to say, well, you know, if it's all that in the bag of chips, why don't do you have it? Well, you know, takes a little time to get the little, take time to make the order and get the order in because it's going crazy. People are ordering like mad when they find out what this product can do. And so, Black Business Billionaire Network Club, we're all about business, economic development, and opportunities for us to grow, not only mentally, physically, historically, and understand history, but also financially. We'd like to see our listeners get a financial growth as well. And so I want you, sir, ma'am, to explore this opportunity with us. I want you to go through this process and see how this works. It is just fantastic. I mean, you know, it doesn't hurt. You're going to buy pillowcases, sheets, and stuff like that already. I don't know about the eye part, but you're going to buy that stuff already. Why not buy pillowcases and sheets with these incredible crystals that help heal your body, heal your mind, heal your eyes, heal you, you know, just a total amazing weight loss as well. You know, people also reported losing weight. So this is just fantastic. This is amazing. And I think everybody took advantage of it, and it is exploding all over the world. And people are making crazy money. One reason people are making crazy money, the demand, once people see the tapes and the videos and get all of the reported, information coming in from people, giving their testimonies, people buying these things like hotcakes. So, sir, ma'am, Sleep M, I suggest you get involved. I suggest you find out to get involved. You can email me at REVRON, the number 11, at gmail.com. You can call me at 518-866-7605. 518-866-7605. Get in on this action. Get in on this. This is going to be a game changer economically, physiologically, psychologically. It's going to be a process of healing one's body, of getting one in better shape and condition. I know I have pain in my knees. I would love to get these sheets and whatnot. And like I said, cataract removal, you know, whatever. Get the iPad and wear that at night while I'm sleeping, and let these crystal miracles do their job and see how they work out. There is internal fighting and bickering in the Republican Party, the Democratic Party. They're fighting about $2.1 trillion debt ceiling, that economy budget, the economic budget that President Biden put out. And the Republicans didn't want a debt ceiling. They didn't want to put out that much of a budget. But the budget is going to increase Social Security retirement, Social Security disability insurance, welfare, food stamps, infrastructure development, schools. So he's putting a tremendous amount of money out there to rebuild America, and there is a fight against it. In the African-American corner of things, you know, we are fighting with injustice. We are fighting with political disparity. We are fighting with economic and educational disparities. We are fighting with food dead zone disparities in the poor communities of the African-American and Latino and communities of color, minorities, or whatever you want to call it. There is a lot of sugar and salt, and, you know, there's not a lot of pure, clean, good, down-to-earth, organic food. And so we're struggling, and kids are finding themselves with all types of mental and physiological problems. And so watch what your children eat. Be careful, because it messes with their mind. We've seen a lot of tragedies with children. A 6-year-old child went with a gun to school and shot the teacher. Tragic with tragic results. I don't know how a young 6-year-old kid can get that angry and know to get a gun and know to do all of that. I don't know what kind of parents he have or what influences that he had to make him get that gun and go to the school with the gun, because it's premeditated. When you leave your home with a weapon to kill somebody, that's considered premeditated. So it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for the teacher. It's a tragedy for the child who might end up spending a large percentage of his life in jail. How did we got here? How did America get to this point? And a lot of it is because of, social ills, man, that have been covered up, the social legacy of the evilness to people and enslavement and killing of the Native Americans and, just a bunch of negative stuff, man, very violent and negative stuff. I mean, slavery was extremely violent. They used to put naked babies on the floor and put their feet on them for feet warmers. Just dehumanizing, just really mean, and they would kill off the Native Americans and take the land and get them drunk and, buy land for a dollar and all those kind of craziness. So there's a lot of history of evilness that have not been addressed yet. And what happened is they took the evilness instead of addressing it and trying to change it and do better. They covered it up and they came with a new level of evilness. Like David Duke, the head of the KKK, he said it's time for us to take off these sheets off our head, put on suits and ties, get government jobs, get law enforcement jobs, get jobs of power, and take over America, take America back. So this is what you have. You have this tremendous amount of people who are doing evil in America in the name of democracy, in the name of God, in the name of liberalism, in the name of peace, in the name of equity, in the name of liberation. America talks about the right for a person to pursue liberty and justice for all, and the right to verity and social integration, and the great melting pot, the great example that America is supposed to be. So, we face all of this tyranny right now. We got children getting killed by adults in Florida, and they got stand your ground laws, and they're saying that these killings apply to the stand your ground laws, and these people are shooting these kids behind their fences where they're playing. 12 and 13 year old kids. It's evil. 9-year old boy was killed by a white man, and it's just continuous evil. And you wonder sometimes how people can be so mean and so demonic and so evil. Country which says, "In God we trust, and we love God, and we're Christians, and we want to hold up the bloodstained banner. We want to love Jesus. We want to love church, state, and fellowship." And we end up in these conditions now that we're in, where it's just pure evil. And it is getting worse and worse and worse. There is not a situation where there is a change, it continues to go on and on and on, year after year after year, decade after decade, and you get tired. You get tired of fighting with these people. You get tired of discussing it with others. You get tired of the agony over it. You get tired of going to bed and thinking about a child that was hurt, killed, maimed, molested, violated. You get tired. You know, you get it can take, if you don't pray, if you don't meditate and you don't find some level of peace, you find yourself in a great, great disorientation, you know, that you probably can't get yourself out of. It's overwhelming. It's very extremely overwhelming, and it's causing a lot of difficulties in the United States of America because people just are tired. The good people are tired of fighting and trying to reconcile with one another and trying to pull things back together. People are getting extremely, you know, tired of the continuous agony of trying to hold things together, you know, and it's causing a lot of rifts in the society. It's causing a lot of problems in the government, and the government itself has problems, and the people in the government do not know how to cooperate with one another. The Republicans and the Democrats are at each other's throat. They talk about each other like dogs. They want to fight, you know, and in the meantime, between time, the government is dysfunctional, and the methodology of correction is not there. The government is falling apart, and nobody's watching the office. The president is an old man. He's going through some dementia or whatever things he has to go through with, and he's trying to hold it together, but he got people coming against him. Marjorie Greene is a vicious woman. She's truly ignorant and truly angry about everything, and nobody knows what she's angry about. She comes from a very wealthy family. She don't need to work. She don't need money, and she just want to fight. She's in a constant battle with people all the time. You know, she has no other pittance of things to do. I don't think she has a children. I don't think she has a husband, you know. And she just bored. And she just constantly fighting with the president. She's fighting on the floor. She's fighting with everybody. And she won't let it go. She will not let it go. And so we're content with a lot of conditioning, a lot of circumstances that are overwhelming. It's overwhelming to us. And it's causing us a lot of heartache. And so as we go forward, and as we try to move forward and try to make things better in the society, as we try to work together and unify the country, it's getting more difficult and difficult at every turn. It is just not what you want. You have people like Tucker Carlson, who is tremendously angry at everything, and he will say whatever he wants to say. He will do whatever he wants to do. There's nobody in the higher level of the network that he's with. He's not a legitimate news journalist, correspondent. He got a job through friends, and he doesn't know what he's doing, and he's constantly just causing all kinds of problems. You know, constantly causing difficulties for everyone. He's constantly just picking on people and causing and making ruckus and saying things. He lied about the insurrection on January 16th. He has some footage, and he just showed the good parts of it, and he just wrote the narrative that it was not bad as they said it was. Even though people got killed, people got hurt, and he's going around saying it wasn't a problem. He don't even know if why they would consider it a problem. And it wasn't a big deal. And there was nice people, and they were just trying to protect their country. And, you know, the lies and the narratives that he tells. People have been already in court. They had their day in court. They got jail time. They already been incarcerated. They all been, did the judge already find them criminal? They've got criminal charges. And this man is picking, this man is waiting way after this time. There's no ethics in Fox News. There's no ethics. You know, there's nobody in the Fox News, top brass, the administration, the corporate level. There's no corporate officers in Fox News that are going to say, shut up, curtail him or dismiss him for violation of information. You know, he took information. Kevin McCarthy, whom he hates, been trying to become his friend, been trying to get him to back him. Kevin McCarthy, who just now became the House Speaker because he liked a French hoe, he gave everything up. He gave everything up to become House Speaker for crazy people in the Republican Party that wanted just to position themselves so that they can have power and be ignorant and use it in a very vile way. So Kevin McCarthy was a power hungry. He needed and he wanted, he got that liar, that pathetic liar, George Santos, Senator George Santos, to sit there and pretend, who pretended to be Jewish, who pretended to have a degree, who pretended to work in certain capacities, and all that stuff was a lie. And so George Santos was a part of the Republican Party who were voting for Kevin McCarthy become House Speaker. So even though he lied and did all these vile things, they continue to want him as a senator so he could vote and assist in keeping Kevin McCarthy, to help Kevin McCarthy get enough votes on the Republican side so Kevin McCarthy could become House Speaker. And now that he's still in there and he doesn't side, he have no intentions of leaving. He's gay and has a boyfriend. His boyfriend said he just wanted to get the benefits of being a senator, a U.S. senator, so that when he retires or he leaves, he gets health care for the rest of his life and he gets a salary for the rest of his life. That was his intentions of taking on his position. So they're saying that, you know, with him being one of the votes that Kevin McCarthy needs, that's why Kevin McCarthy maintained for him to stay in the Senate so that he can continue with the mishigash, as the Jewish people say, and the nonsense. And he is continuing to serve in the U.S. Senate, and people do not want him, and his district don't want him, and the leadership in Long Island of the Republican Party, the GOP, they don't want him. And he's not going to leave because he needs the extended amount of time to be there so he can accumulate this financial benefit of this lifetime of medical coverage and financial payment for a substantial amount of time in his life. And so you got all these things going on. You got all this corruption. You got all these things happening. And then we see the children killing each other and fighting and stealing and murdering people for cars and carjacking. And we just see numerous of people on trains, knocking people into the train. Numerous people getting busted in the head on the subways in New York City. They're getting robbed. They're getting stabbed. They're getting shot. It is just crazy in America right now. It's extremely crazy, and we know in the last days these things will happen, but are we in the last days, Jesus? Because things are going not the way you normally would see things go. It's going in a total different direction. It's not the America that they say it is because they're pretentious and they continue to do vile and ignorant and racist, systemic, societal, covert and overt racism in the government. It starts with the government. People take advantage of bad governing procedures. People take advantage of bad laws. People, white people have been taking advantage of the white privilege. They've been taking advantage of laws and implementation of procedures and policies that effectively benefit them and deny African-American people pride in these laws, and they take advantage of them. And that's where the abuse of the citizenry comes. So the citizen who feels that he has an authority, he has the power, and that the other citizen is weak and he's in concern and the government is not protecting him, he's abusive of that citizen. So the African-American community is in that position. And I'm not saying we're weak at all. Trust me, I'm not crying to anyone, and I'm not saying that we're weak at all. I'm saying the conditions that we are in, if we don't realize what it are, then we're going to lose. And so there are people saying, don't say that you're in this position of weakness. It's not weakness. It is the government that's pertaining to these laws that put you in these conditions. So people out there saying, now, don't say that to the white people, that these conditions are not favorable to you and they're affecting you and your lifestyle. And they're having a tremendous impact on your daily existence in America. People say, don't say that. There's a video out now. They say stop telling black immigrants about African Americans to stop telling black immigrants about our problems here in America, because it's not making them see anything any different. It's making them feel that we are weak and that they have a position in power now to take over, that they can kick us down further than what we're being kicked already. So there is a tremendous effort to tell African Americans, don't talk to black immigrants about immigrants from Africa, immigrants from Asia and India and Pakistan and Bangladesh and Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico and Costa Rica, Haiti, Africa, the Caribbean. Don't tell these people when they come here about the problems that we're having with white America, because they're going to see it as a weakness and an opportunity for them to step over us again and take over whatever they try to come over here and take over. But that's going to be a tremendous problem for them, because it's hard to take over something that's already been in existence and already has a structure already. It becomes very impossible to do it, because you're coming from a position of powerlessness in the first place, because you're coming seeking and looking for something and an opportunity to help you develop yourself and expand yourself. That means where you came from, you had a weakness. You had a weakness where you came from that you needed to go someplace else to seek something better. And in that conditioning, you had to find a better place to go that was more welcoming, that had more open arms, of almost like mothering you like a mother or a father, father and mothering you and parenting you. You needed that open arm. You needed that opportunity, which all human beings do need. But don't think that that's going to give you an opportunity to get a heads up on someone else. It's bad to think that you're going to come to another place so you can kick somebody down so you can benefit from their failure, or their pain and their suffering, you know, their annihilation and their discrimination and their government that's been harsh to them. And so instead of you're coming to be a participant of change and assistance, you're coming to, like the devil, seek to destroy and kill and devour whoever you can. Or, you know, like the OJ say, backstabbers, smile in your face and all the time they want to take your place, the backstabbers. And you don't benefit from it because you don't understand the intricate mechanisms that made this whole thing happen from the initial 400 years ago. It's deeper than what you think. Mrs. Immigrant, it's much deeper than what you think. And if you think because you got a job, a car, a house, you got a business, you got clothes, you got little education, if you think that's going to get you to the next level, think again. This is America. This system in America, this political, social, economic system is like nothing you ever experienced. You won't find this in England. You won't find this in Canada, France, Germany, okay, Poland, all right, Portugal, Brazil, Dominican Republic, Haiti, Jamaica, Trinidad, Antigua, Barbuda, Barbados, okay, Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, Congo DR, West and South, East and North Africa. You're not going to find political structure that's called America any place. And so when you come, you're at a disadvantage because you do not know the structure. And African Americans are not begging, pleading, or asking you for sympathy. It was basically most of the time, 99.9% of the time when African Americans tell you the problem in this country, they're trying to hip you to something. They were trying to give you heads up for what's going on so that you can brace yourself for the movement. So because if you don't come into the movement and you stay outside of the movement, you're going to lose anyway because you're going to lose a whole bunch of factors of information that you need as a person of color to succeed in a society that's automatically, systemically, is historically racist. Sometimes it's so racist that they don't know how not to be racist. It's so bedded into the thread of their material. You know, you're making it like a dress being made to the point of exquisiteness. It's so well groomed. It's so well prepared. It's so well. It's like a good seasoned meat that's ready to eat. It's been so well sauteed and seasoned. So you don't know what you're getting into. And my suggestion is that you either stay back and pick no sides or listen and learn and be a skillful listener and learn so that you can earn, so that you can be prosperous, so that you can benefit from your benefit from your stay here. Because it's far few in between that your stay is not stable. A lot of people think, oh, yeah, I'm naturalized. I'm a naturalized citizen. That's not stable. Trump sent a whole bunch of people that were naturalized back to their countries. Not even their countries, because most of them was born here. And most of them was here since they were infants, so they don't know any other country. But even though that they were naturalized, he still sent them back. And there's nobody to say no. Because the conditions of naturalization is not a stable condition. It's not like it's built in stone. You could be naturalized and do something wrong in America, and they could decide when they get you in court to pack you up and send you back to wherever your parents' original origins was from. And you could have been born here. And you could have came here illegal as a baby. And you could have been born here. And they found a way to get you your papers, get you naturalized. But being that your parents are not indigenous here, it's like in England. You are subject of England. America has the same kind of level of attitude. You're a subject of America. And they can release you anytime they want, can send you back anytime they want. The only stable people that's here, it just so happened to be the African-American who was brought here by force. And even those conditions have circumstances in them because there are things that one has to face and one has to deal with. But we've been here long enough to understand the programming, to understand the game. Game got to know game. We understand we're in their ball court, and we understand who are their best players, outfield and infield. We know because we've been here long enough. We've been sitting right next to them. We've been sleeping and eating with them. We know them well. They do not know. I'm going to tell you something. White Americans do not know African Americans as well as we know them. And the reason is they don't have to know us. They had the power to not know us. They don't have to want to know us because there was nothing that they could benefit from knowing us. But what they didn't understand is that the creativity, the ability, the inventions, the stability, the nature of us, who we were, the indigenous of our ability, they didn't understand it. But they come to understand it. The Bible said you understand it better by and by, over a period of time. And then when it hit them, it shocked the hell out of them, and they couldn't handle it. Black Wall Street was so powerful, so beautiful. It was keep America alive. America lost everything. It was a great, great, great depression. They had nothing. And then when they woke up and they saw, damn, they were getting everything from black people, African-American people. African-American community was keeping them working, was paying them for labor, paying them for supplies and materials, putting them back to work, spending the money, giving them loans, coming to the African-American banks to get loans. Jews came to America, had to go to African-American historical black colleges and universities to study. They couldn't study in the white man college. Most Europeans had to come and study in the black in the African-American universities and colleges. Most of the immigrants, black immigrants, had to study in the African-American colleges. Their job opportunities came from the African-American community. Their first job experiences being hired by African-American businesses. All of the development and opportunity that was manufacturing factories, all those things were developed and implemented by the creativity and of African Americans. There was a time when only 50 people out of the whole countries of Africa, the Caribbean, and Asia, and the Middle East and the Arab countries, there was a time before the 1965 Immigration Act, there was a time when there was only 50 people out the whole country could come to America. 100 people out the whole country could come to America per year. And it's only a few that could stay and get a work permit and a green card and get naturalized. Very few. Until Dr. King implemented the 1965 Immigration Act and black people could come and like white people came freely. So when you come here to America, you have to understand the logistics of everything. What made it up? What gave you the opportunities that you have to come here? And then you want to pretend like nothing, nobody never was here before. Nobody did nothing. You did everything yourself. You came here on your own. You got that good job on your own. You went to school and got educated on your own. You got that salary on your own. You got that car on your own. You got that house on your own. No, you did not. Somebody had to pave the way for you to have the opportunity to get those things. And even sacrifice their situation to keep continually fighting. African Americans continue to fight to the point where we lost our houses and our homes and our cars and up in projects and welfare and et cetera and homeless while you bastard in homes and cars because you pander to the white man's needs and concerns. And you don't want to hear that. Nobody wants to hear that. Nobody. You have very few people who immigrate here wants to hear February, African American History Month, and here to the historical facts of history. That's why they can plunder and cringe and dissect history to what they want it to be. His story, their story, the white man's story. How they help people develop a country and did all the mechanisms and all the historical facts and putting everything together to make this thing operate. So when people come here today, whether you go on an airplane, African American airplane, mechanical technology, African American, the fact that you can come here, African American, the fact that you have the right to come here, African American, you have to give. The Bible said, "Give Caesar what's due Caesar. Give praise unto those who deserve praises." God said, "Give it to them." But people want to pretend that everything they did was on their own. They're a one man show, one woman show. They came here and they just like Columbus, just stop finding stuff. Stuff wasn't here before. They just came here and started looking, and they found things. No, no, no. No, 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 no. I repudiate that. You would not continue, not on Ronnie Robinson's time. I will disseminate every deceitful word, and people take advantage to situation when the situation is pondering against one person. People see a group of people, and when they see you weak, they ponder with that. They pleasure themselves to the deceiver, to the creator of the deceit and the demising of a people. So when you come to America, you go run into that white man because you're pondering his image, his desires, so that you can succeed and get a job and get a cup of coffee and get a sandwich. I don't know what you're trying to achieve. Get a car, get a house, go to school. He knows that. He knows exactly your premonition. He knows exactly what things the dangle in front of you to make you do whatever he wants. Like you've been hypnotized, and Simon says, and he tells you what to do. He knows, and you know, but you don't care, because that car, that house, that diamond, that robe, that clothes, the job, the position, the power, you come over here seeking that. You come over here pleasuring for that. You come over here thirsty for that. But you find yourself in a very demising condition, because they have no desire to see you at any point or any place, just to use you for the division, just to use you to demise their point, just to use you to lift their ignorance to where they want it to be. They just want partners in their destructive behavior. And you can go and be that partner. That's fine. That's fine, sir, ma'am, what you want. You can go ahead and be that partner. That's fine. No, I'm not going to, it is what it is, but you will not succeed. You might think you're succeeding. You might think, but those things are temporal. When America get mad at you, they can pick up and throw you right back where you came from and never look back. Take everything that you accumulated and throw you back. If you fringe on their property, on their land where the white Americans live, if you start to impede on their places, what they want to keep exclusively white for themselves, if you come near the boundaries of their areas that they have written off, if you come invade their space, they will send you back where you come from before God get the message. You get back there so quick you think a jet took you back. At the speed of light, they'll have you going back so fast. So be careful how you ponder with the wrong people. Be careful how you manipulate with the wrong people, how you participate with the wrong game. When you go to the wrong court, you're on the wrong team, on the wrong side. When you go into the wrong ditch, in the wrong war, in the wrong Navy, in the wrong Army, in the wrong Air Force, or the wrong Marine. You got to know where you stand and where you at. And the only way you're going to know that when you come to a place the first time is you got to learn. You got to sit back and observe, and you have to listen, and you have to learn and educate yourself and get yourself up to the point where you understand exactly what is going. And once you can do that, then you can succeed in life and you can be successful. Don't stop picking corners and picking size. Don't stop picking sides because you think one side is stronger than the other. You don't know what the side. You don't know which side is stronger and which one is weak, because you don't understand the structure. You don't know how to set up. Most people come to America, they don't know the political, social, economic structure. They don't understand how it's been manipulated, how it's been corroborated, how it's been developed. There's a lot to learn. And I would suggest that you stay in a learning pattern. You become a junior student. Stay learning. If you don't want to jump on the side that you need to be on, at least pick no side. because you're not prepared for this war. You're not well equipped. You don't have the insight nor the diagram. You don't even know the justification of the war. In 400 years, nobody's waiting for you to come here 20 years, 10 years, 1 year, 2 years, 6 months, and know what you're doing. You're out of whack. You're out of position. It's not going to work, people. It's not going to work. And I advise that you find a neutral corner. If you're not going to participate in the survival of the less fittest, the demised, the dehumanized, the marginalized, then don't even pick up, because you'll never participate with the stronghold of the struggle of the powerful influences of the United States of America. It's a big game. You're playing with the big boys now. It's a whole nother structure. It's a whole nother type of game. So my thing is buyer beware, be prepared, and take on that which you know you can handle. We're going to open up the mics and we're going to hear what the listeners have to say as well. We're going to open up 929-66.
Hey, listen. They have the 15-year-old, 14-year-old now. You
talk about that.
Yeah. Don't talk about that.
They're busy. And we're going to listen to a history of slavery in America and how we got to this point and what happened, so you can understand why we are here, and it's who we are. That's the name of the program. And we're going to learn from the beginning to the end what is America. What is an African-American? What is slavery? What's the conditioning? How it happened? We're going to listen to a professor, a prosecuting attorney, Jeffrey Robinson, and he has done extensive research and study, and he has spoken to people all over the country concerning slavery and how we got here. Let's listen to him.
If you have ever owned a slave, please raise your hand. Slavery is not our fault. We didn't do it. We didn't cause it. It's not our responsibility, but it is our shared history. And when we try and turn it into something that it's not, when we try and make more light of it than it was, then we are denying who we really are, and we are impeding our ability to truly move forward as a community or as a nation.
In most cases, in the South, that's the way it worked, because they were treated as family, and they knew what they had. They didn't know what they were being faced with if they left.
So your view is that enslaved people were treated as family?
That's basically the way it was down South.
So what I want to talk to you about is part of the ugliness of our history. I want all of us to understand just how we laid the groundwork to own other human beings as property. And so I think what I'm looking at are shackles that were designed for an adult male and shackles that were designed for a child of maybe 3 or 4.
Yes, yes.
41 of the 56 people who signed the Declaration of Independence owned other human beings as property. When they were talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they saw that as being completely consistent with enslaving people.
Question. What kind of things happened here?
Lynchings or hangings took place here on this very spot.
Black folks here in Charleston refer to it as the lynching tree. America has demonstrated its greatness time and time and time again, and America is one of the most racist countries on the face of the earth. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. It is not an either or.
There must be a revolution of values in our country, because some of the values that presently exist are certainly out of line with the idealistic structure that brought our nation into being.
I was 11 years old in 1968, and to my young eyes, we had been on a path toward racial justice that was amazing. There was the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and we were seemingly, to me, at a tipping point where we were either going to roll forward with this incredible momentum on racial justice, or we could roll back. And then April 4th happened, and King got shot in the neck, and it felt like the whole thing just rolled back.
And a man grabbed me by the arm and said, "We don't allow blacks in the gym." And I remember turning to y'all and I said, "They've got a problem with the clock and with what's going on here. We all are out here. We're leaving."
I didn't know that.
I figured not.
Once again, America is having to look at issues of race dead in the eye. And once again, we are at a tipping point. And the reason I'm asking us to think about this is that literally the future is at stake.
And Larry, he came out with his hands in the air and said, "Don't shoot." Put the shotgun in his stomach and pulled the trigger at close range.
And what I'm going to ask us to do tonight is to have a naked lunch moment with race in America. It's that moment when everyone has to take a look at what is really on the end of their fork.
If I may ask you a question, Jeff, perhaps if Dylann Roof was educated, if he understood that he may not have gone down this path, what are your thoughts?
This is not going to be easy, but I can promise you this. It will never get easier to have an honest discussion about race in America than it is right now. Because if we wait, it is only going to get harder.
The Larry that you heard referred to in that trailer was a young man named Larry Payne, who was 6 years older than I was, and he was killed in Memphis, Tennessee the week before King was assassinated, 1 week to the day. There was a march in support of striking sanitation workers, and that march broke into violence. Larry was confronted by a police officer who put a shotgun in his stomach and pulled the trigger. And his memory has been one of the things that's been forgotten about the garbage strike and the movement in Memphis. So I am Jeff Robinson, and I am a criminal defense lawyer from Seattle, Washington. And you could be asking, why are you here and why are you doing this? And that would be a completely legitimate question. And this is the way I'm going to answer it. In 2011, I became a parent because my wife's younger sister, Jeannie, who lived in Queens, New York, was suffering from MS and she passed away. And her 13-year-old son, Matthew, my nephew, then became my 13-year-old son because he was being raised by Jeannie and Jeannie's mother. Jeannie passed away in April of 2011, and her mom, my wife's mom, passed away in November of 2011. So Matt lost both of his parents. His father was never in the picture, and he moved to Seattle. Now, I was terrified about being a parent because I didn't know anything about how to do that. And I was scared a lot. But I was more scared because there was a young black man that moved into my home. And my work as a criminal defense lawyer in Seattle had been for 30 or 35 years working on issues of racial justice, working on issues for clients of color, working and speaking around the country on these issues. They were very important to me, but they were academic to a certain extent until Matthew showed up on my doorstep. And I got scared. And one of the reasons I was scared is that there had been a narrative going on in America about young black men for more than a decade, and it went something like this.
They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heal.
Bring them to heal. As soon as you start talking about human beings like they're animals, get ready for some really bad shit to come. Because that's how we do it in America. We dehumanize people before we start to treat them as less than human. And so I was scared and I didn't know what to do, and I just started reading. And as I started reading, I was shocked. I didn't even know what I was looking for. But I started reading facts about our history in America that I had never seen before, that I had never heard before. And it was just scaring me, and it was shocking me. And it was shocking me because, as I said in that clip, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee in 1956, and was assassinated in 1968. The civil rights movement wasn't something I read about in a book. It was what we were living when we stepped out the door of our house in the black neighborhoods in Memphis, Tennessee, every day of our lives. And yet I was reading about these facts about our history that I had never heard before. I have had one of the best educations in America. I went to Marquette University and Harvard Law School, and nobody ever taught me this stuff. And so I felt humiliated. And then I felt angry because I thought, well, how come nobody taught me this? And so I thought, I'm going to forgive myself and get pissed off at my teachers, and I'll blame them. And then I thought, well, how could they have taught me if they weren't taught? And the amazing thing about this stuff is that these facts are hiding in plain sight. All you have to do is go and look, because human beings from the time of the cave drawings in France that are 30,000 years old, human beings have a trait that has always been part of our existence. When we think we're doing something important, we write stuff down. And we keep it so people can read it later. And our history, from the time the colony started, is written down in plain fact for anybody that wants to take a look. And so I started to take a look, and I started to do these presentations about 7 or 8 years ago. And as they developed, I kept doing them, and I gave a presentation in 2017 in New York City. And one of the people in the audience was a woman named Sarah Kunstler. Is Sarah's father-in-law in the audience? Do I hear anybody? Could you stand up and introduce yourself, please? Thank you, John, for coming, and I please give him a hand. Because Sarah Kunstler is the daughter of the famed civil rights lawyer William Kunstler. And Sarah came up to me after the presentation and said, I'd like you to meet my sister Emily, because we own a film company and we'd like to make a documentary about your presentation. And I thought that was the most stupid thing I had ever heard in my entire life. 1 year later, we are performing in Town Hall Theater on Broadway in New York City in front of a sold-out audience with 7 cameras filming. And since that time, we have gone across America filming interviews to put together a documentary called Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. What I'm here to do tonight is to give you an idea of what this documentary will cover and to give you a sense of the arc of the documentary, because I think that's perhaps the most important thing about this film is the arc that we're trying to cover. When people talk about slavery and atrocities that have happened in our past, what we often hear is, yeah, but that was a long time ago. It doesn't have any impact on the way things are today. And that's something that I want to challenge with this film. And so what I'd like to do is to walk through 4 segments of this arc. And this won't be everything that the documentary covers, I promise you that. But it will give you a flavor for the things that I think can make America look at who we are differently and can make us take steps that we have not yet taken in our existence. This stuff was hiding in plain sight. The term white supremacy is a difficult term and an extreme term, and I think it is used, and some people feel that it might be overused. What I want you to consider is that white supremacy was one of the founding pillars of American society. Now, if you think that's an overstatement, in the documentary, we will walk through the historical documents that will lay this out clearly. But some of what you'll see is that we know in 1619 we have these records of 20 and odd enslaved people landing somewhere near Jamestown, Virginia. But did you know that by 1790, American cotton production had grown to 1.5 million pounds a year? Has anybody on the stage ever held a freshly picked piece of cotton in your hand? And I don't mean something out of an aspirin bottle, but like out of a field, no twigs. How much does it weigh? I can't tell you how many cotton balls that weigh near nothing it took to get to 1.5 million pounds, but I can tell you how many enslaved people it took, 700,000. In 171 years, America went from 20 and odd enslaved people to 700,000. And the details behind this story are part of what we will paint in the documentary with historical documents. Many people will say, if you're talking about the history of enslavement in America, you really can't talk about the colonies because that wasn't America yet. America didn't happen until we broke away from England. And what I'd like you to think about in terms of the arc of this story is that the white supremacy that was at the heart of the economic life of the colonial Americans was doubled down upon when we wrote our Constitution. Article 1, Section 2 is the three-fifths clause. Every black person in America was counted as three-fifths of a human being. If I asked people in this room before I started this presentation, what is affirmative action? Almost all of us would say, oh, those were programs of uplift in the 60s and 70s directed at the black community. And then at some point the U.S. Supreme Court said, hey, that's reverse discrimination, and now there's kind of a balance. I'm not quite sure where it is. Many Americans think affirmative action started in the 1960s. Can you think of a more powerful form of affirmative action than giving one race of people the right to own another race? Article 1, Section 9, no ban on migration or importation of such persons before 1808. The word slavery, enslaved or slave, did not appear in the Constitution until the 13th Amendment. We'll get to that in a minute. Because the North understood that the South was upset by that word. It was kind of harsh. And so enslaved people were referred to as such persons. And no ban on migration meant that we need to keep the ships going to Africa to bring more enslaved people back because we are getting rich off of this. We can't cut this trade off until 1808. Article 2, Section 1. Each state shall appoint a number of electors equal to the number. One reason, to give the southern states a guarantee that they would have a significant role in electing the president of the United States. And here is where you will hear letters from people like Patrick Henry. Remember him, y'all? Give me liberty or give me death. Well, when the Constitutional Convention was happening, people thought they were doing something important. So they wrote stuff down. And Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet, so people had to write letters to each other. And Patrick Henry, you will see in the documentary, an actor reading Patrick Henry's letter about, there are 236,000 blacks in Virginia. and few or none in the northern states. Multiply 236,000 by three-fifths, and you still get a big number, especially considering the size of America at the time. This was done directly to further the interest of the slave-owning states. Article 4, Section 2, no freedom for any runaway slave, must be returned on demand. And I was telling Art earlier, I've been giving this presentation or some version of it for 7 or 8 years, and I have just realized recently that this document says an incredible thing. This part of the Constitution makes it clear that from the first day that this country came into existence, America turned to its law enforcement officers and said, your job is to control, contain, and suppress every black face in America. We wrote it in the Constitution. Because if there's no freedom for a runaway, what does that mean? The United States Marshals Service is on you to bring you back to your owner. And finally, people say the folks that wrote the Constitution were brilliant, and they were. Go back to Article 1, Section 9. No state could pass a law saying you can't bring enslaved people from Africa into our state, because that would be unconstitutional. But these folks were wily. They said, what if folks try and amend the Constitution? And so they doubled down and they said, you can't amend Article 1, Section 9 until after 1808. They were going to keep those ships coming. The word slavery is mentioned once in the 13th Amendment, which did not rid America of slavery. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime, shall exist within the United States. That means that slavery and involuntary servitude do exist for people who have been convicted of a crime. Think about the new Jim Crow and mass incarceration in the light of this amendment. This was not done by mistake. And the documentary will demonstrate people knew exactly what they were doing when they wrote this amendment. So I wish I could see a show of hands. How many people know who the Colonial Marines were? I am trying to demonstrate how we have been deprived of the truth about our history. If you were never taught who the Colonial Marines were, the Colonial Marines were escaped enslaved people that fought for the British in the War of Independence and during the War of 1812. Why? Because the British said, if we win, you get your freedom. And the Colonial Marines in the War of 1812 were part of British troops that attacked the Americans right outside of Washington, D.C., drove them back into Washington, D.C., and set the White House on fire. And one of the people who was watching that happen was Francis Scott Key. And 3.5 weeks later, he was in Baltimore Harbor watching the bombing of Fort McHenry. And after 25 consecutive hours of bombing, when he saw the American flag still flying, he became overcome with patriotic fervor, and he wrote the poem that became the national anthem.
And where is that band who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle of home and country should leave us no more? Their blood
No refuge can save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight, because we will hunt you down, or the gloom of the grave, because we will put you in the dirt if you dare fight against America for your freedom. And there are historians who will be anxious to tell you, well, Francis Scott Key wasn't talking about those enslaved people. He was talking about some other enslaved people. Francis Scott Key was a virulent racist. Francis Scott Key prosecuted a man in Washington, D.C. after the Civil War for possessing abolitionist literature, which carried the death penalty. Francis Scott Key called black Americans the worst plight to ever be inflicted on America. This is who wrote our national anthem, and these are the words. We may not sing them anymore, but they're there. And if you didn't know this, I wonder what you might think of black athletes who kneel quietly protesting racial injustice, knowing that this is our national anthem. And in the documentary, we will use all kinds of evidence to demonstrate just how much America relied on enslaving people. But this is an example of what it was about. The 1856 unique defense to the charge of murder that was put forward on behalf of Margaret Garner. And what Margaret Garner did is best described by a newspaper article from the Cincinnati Enquirer from 1856.
Great excitement existed throughout the city the whole day of yesterday in consequence of the arrest of a party of slaves and the murder of her child by a slave mother while officers were in the act of making the arrest. A party of 17 slaves escaped from Boone and Kenton counties in Kentucky about 16 miles from the Ohio on Sunday night last, and taking with them two horses and a sled, drove that night to the Ohio River opposite to Western Row in this city. Leaving the horses and sled standing there, they crossed the river on foot,
cross the river
on the ice, on foot, on the ice.
One of the narratives in America that has been very popular is that, yes, slavery was a bad thing, but it wasn't that bad. There were like good living conditions, and they had good food, and they were treated okay. Just how bad does it have to be for you to take your family and cross the Ohio River in the middle of the winter on foot, on the ice, not knowing if the ice will break for you to fall through? It was bad enough that Margaret Garner and her family took that risk. And when the U.S. Marshals showed up the next day in Cincinnati to arrest her, as the Constitution required them to do, Margaret Garner took a knife, grabbed her daughter, and slit her throat. Then she went after her sons, and the marshals got to her before she could complete her task. This is an oil painting, a rendering of what Margaret Garner did, experienced. And Alfre Woodard helped us with reading that poem at the event in Town Hall in New York.
Then, said the mournful mother, if Ohio cannot save, I will do a deed for freedom. She shall find each child a grave. I will save my precious children from their darkly threatened doom. I will hew their path to freedom through the portals of the tomb. A moment in the sunlight, she held a glimmering knife. The next moment, she had bathed it in the crimson fount of life. They snatched away the fatal knife. Her boys shrieked, wild with dread. The baby girl was pale and cold. They raised it up. The child was dead. Send this deed for fearful daring through my country's heart, no thrill. Do the icy hands of slavery every pure emotion chill?
Like this. This is what slavery was. It wasn't something else. This is who we are as Americans when we talk about our history, because Margaret Garner was charged with first-degree murder for killing her daughter, and the murder charges were dismissed, because in order to be convicted of first-degree murder, you have to kill a human being. And what Margaret Garner killed was an enslaved child. So Margaret Garner, her husband, and her three sons were returned to their owners to live out the rest of the Civil War.
And we are still dealing with this debate. 57% of Americans saying that Confederate flag is a symbol of Southern pride. Well, let's remember, that flag disappeared until 1948, and who brought it back? Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrat Party. And what was their platform? We stand for segregation of the races. They knew what this flag stood for.
Slavery had nothing to do with the war. That was not the cause of the Southern states seceding. That was not the cause of the first shot being fired on that fort over there. It was about money. And it was not about slavery. It was about moral tariffs. It was about more money. Lincoln wanted to impose 45% more taxes on the Southern states.
Taxes on the goods the Southern states were producing. And those goods were essentially cotton, tobacco, and rice.
Slavery had nothing to do.
And those goods were produced by slave labor. All of it. Isn't that right?
No, I mean, the
95% of it? Isn't that right? If it's 95% produced by slave labor, enslaved people, and the North is saying, we're going to tax you on that because we want some of that money, and the South is saying, no, wait a minute, we're the ones producing it, so you shouldn't be taking the money. That money wouldn't exist without slave labor. I mean, that did affect the bottom line. Wouldn't you agree with that?
They chose to stay. In most cases in the South, that's the way it worked, because they were treated as family, and they knew what they had. They didn't know what they were being faced with if they left.
So your view is that enslaved people treated as family? Then why wouldn't it be all right for me to own you as long as I treated you like family?
If that's the way economics work?
Would you be satisfied with that?
In today's world.
In any world.
In today's time?
In any time.
Charleston, South Carolina was the port through which almost 40% of every African-American enslaved person that came to this country came through. This is on the waterfront in Charleston, South Carolina. These men are there demonstrating every weekend, every Sunday. Cars drive by, beep horns, yell out words of encouragement, and their view is that the Civil War had nothing to do with enslaving people, and that enslaved people were treated as family. This conversation was difficult because literally the day before we had been to the Charleston Slave Mart Museum. And trust me, this is not how family was treated.
We are standing in front of the Chalmers Street entrance of the old Slave Mart Museum. This structure and this complex was created as a response to the outdoor sale of enslaved populations within the city of Charleston. By the 1850s, the outdoor sale of enslaved people that had been going on since the founding of the colony in 1670 was being seen as somewhat of an aberrant eyesore. Now, what is a large parking lot behind this building today was originally a massive pen that contained a four-story jail building utilized to house enslaved people prior to the day of sale. There was a two-story kitchen building back there for nutritional needs, as well as prepping the enslaved, and a morgue building, or more accurately, a dead house, for sick and dying enslaved. They would sell enslaved people out of this location
kids 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday. Everyone from newborns to 70-year-olds were sold out of here. For enslaved people to make the most money for the traders and for the sellers, they have to be prepped first. Prep could be everything from high-fat and high-protein diets to get them into better physical shape, as well as, you know, fresh clothing. You have the sort of prepping of the skin through oiling. If they're looking a little bit older, they could either dye the hair or pluck any grays that someone would have, things of that nature, in order to, when they come up onto the block, they're able to garner the largest amount of money.
And I'm looking at a list of Negroes,
mm-hmm.
and it says, number one, the name is Sunday, the age is 45.
Enslaved people, they didn't have last names generally until the 1870 census. And so it was the question of, what is your name?
Because the names could be changed each time you were sold?
They would be changed. That's the first thing that is changed every time you're sold. So on all broadsides you will ever see, this is just the name they come to the sale with. And keep in mind that the enslaved property of slave owners was worth more than everything else they owned. Was worth more than the plantation. It was worth more than the land, more than the goods that are produced on that plantation, more than the house, more than any other liveries that they have. So the first thing that's going to be sold to pay for a debt is, you know, enslaved. Because you didn't have to buy them outright. You could mortgage them. So this is representative of a pricing chart. There are four factors that define how much an enslaved person is ultimately sold for. The first is age. The younger you are, because it's a future investment, the more valuable you are. Also, there's something called prime. It was enslaved individuals from about the age of 10 to 12 to the age of about 25. For males, it was the amount of work they can do in that time. You're very strong, you're very virile. And for females, it's the amount of children they can produce. And so you have the subcategories. Based on age, skills, health, and skin tone. And so when it came to movement of enslaved prior to being brought onto that block, they're going to be chained.
Mm-hmm.
Now everyone's going to be chained. It's not just going to be grown-ups. It's not going to be the elderly. It'll also be the children.
And so I think what I'm looking at are shackles that were designed for an adult male and shackles that were designed for a child of maybe 3 or 4.
Yes, yes. And again, you know, as I mentioned, that blacksmithing was a job that enslaved people would do. They could be in charge of making shackles.
Let's go upstairs.
Sure.
Well, how hard is it for you to work here and do this every day? Because it has to take a toll.
It does. It does.
I get that.
Yeah. But I'm also really lucky. This is a physical aspect of control. This is the end piece of a very large whip. It was originally about 6 feet long. And if you look very closely, there are braided bits.
Yes.
Nails driven into the leather wrap, and that would act as a way to both, you know, stiffen it, but also to bite into the skin.
Ista, I would like to ask, what are the three holes that I see in these bricks in the walls there?
They're fingerprints. Enslaved people would begin to learn a skill at the age of about 6.
Mm-hmm.
And so fingerprints and handprints and thumbprints exist all throughout the city because enslaved people build the city. As you can see, my fingers don't fit because this brick was not made by an adult.
It was made by a child.
Yes. Yes. And so on churches, on businesses, on in alleyways. You see these in theaters. You see these all throughout the city in very, very subtle ways. And if you don't know what you're looking for, you may not see them.
But they're there.
Absolutely. And they are a way of the enslaved who created this city and created the economy that created this country to remind us, hey, I was here too.
That is an example of what we are going to try and do with the time period from colonial times to the Civil War. And one of the things that Art and I were talking about earlier is that we talked about America's reaction to things like when the movie Roots came out and when other things have come out. And America has, it seems like for a moment, looked and said, my God, that's really horrible, and then moved on. And part of it is because I think we have been insufficient in making, or we have not worked hard enough to make the connections from 1619 to 2020. And part of the purpose of this documentary is to try and make those connections, to say to people, there is a direct and unbroken line from the white supremacy that let the colonial Americans get rich by bringing enslaved people from Africa to the white supremacy that exists today. And if that unbroken line can be established, I think you get people to a different place. The end of the connection to the Civil War, by 1861, remember in 1790, 1.5 million pounds of cotton a year? By 1861, it was 2.3 billion pounds a year. 60% of all U.S. exports. Folks, this is how America got rich. The number of enslaved people was now 4 million. I'm not saying, let's be clear, that America enslaved 4 million people between 1619 and 1861. It was much, much more than that. I'm saying there were 4 million alive in 1861. The value of enslaved people in 1861, $3.5 billion, more than all the money in circulation in America at the time, and worth more than $100 billion in today's money. The richest part of America, most millionaires per capita, the Mississippi Valley. Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana, one of the poorest places in America today because the labor of enslaved people has never been replaced in those economies. And understand, enslaved people were more than just free labor. You had to buy them, and so you take out a loan, and you have to pay interest on the loan. You had to take out insurance policies. The sales were taxed and notarized. Everybody was making this money. And so let's skip forward, because the documentary will not do the skipping. We will cover more area after the Civil War. But let's skip forward to the first half of the 20th century, and I want to talk about the Tulsa Massacre. I guarantee you, many, many, many Americans learned about the Tulsa Massacre from watching something called The Watchmen on HBO. And what I'll say that's great and bad about that, on the one hand, I can't believe it takes a cartoon movie for America to learn about one of the worst mass killings in our history. On the other hand, if that's what informed people and they now know about it, at least they now know. The Greenwood neighborhood of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was one of the richest neighborhoods in America in 1921. I didn't say one of the richest black neighborhoods in America. I said one of the richest neighborhoods in America. 1921, there were businesses, churches, restaurants, grocery stores, movie theaters, private airplanes. There was a hospital. There was a post office. There were schools, libraries, a law office. They even had a bus system. On May 31st, 1921, a young black man was arrested for supposedly assaulting a white woman. And you can go back and look at the newspapers, even that were written then. And at most, this young man bumped into this woman and she screamed. The narrative in the black community, of course, is that they were involved with each other and they were kissing, and another white person walked into the elevator and she had to scream. At any rate, this young man was arrested and taken down to the jail. And a lynch mob was formed. But what they forgot was that the black men in the Greenwood area of Tulsa, Oklahoma, had served in World War I, and they still had their long rifles, and they were trained in military efficiency. And they came down and surrounded the courthouse and kept the lynch mob out. Not one white person was injured that night. A shot was fired when there was a scuffle over a gun, a white man saying to one of the black men, "Boy, what are you going to do with that gun?" And the black man responding, "Use it if I have to." The lynch mob was turned away, and the next day, the Greenwood neighborhood of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was burned to the ground. Many people think it was a street, Black Wall Street. It was 4 square miles that were burned to the ground. And in doing our research, we came across in an old Fox movie tone file actual footage that was filmed on June 1st, 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
keep on driving. God's gonna make you
better.
Gotta get better.